We're looking at live pictures at Trump Tower, of Trump Tower, where former President Trump is expected to depart for court any minute.
This week, former President Donald Trump headed back into court for his first criminal trial in New York City.
You saw him there. He walked out, kind of gave like a fist pump, right? Is that what you saw, John?
Yeah, I saw a fist pump.
Trump faces 34 felony charges for falsifying documents related to hush money payments made to the adult film star Stormy Daniels around the time of the 2016 election. But at the heart of this case is a much larger catch-and-kill scheme that involves the former president, his former lawyer Michael Cohen, and a tabloid, the National Enquirer. My colleague Ronan Farrow has reported extensively on this scheme and spoke directly with many of the players involved.
The fact that a candidate is willing to so aggressively manipulate the media and, far from welcoming transparency, is putting up these smoke screens and is willing to break the law and fudge the rules and do shady accounting to achieve that. That, to me, felt like a real story.
I asked him to come on the show to explain why the Manhattan District Attorney's case is about more than just Stormy Daniels and what he expects to see in court from his sources. You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. Hey, Ronan. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Tyler. Great to be here.
So, Ronan, I'd like to start with going back to August of 2015. That's when, according to the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, there was a meeting at Trump Tower between Trump, his then lawyer at the time, Michael Cohen, and then the CEO of a company called American Media Incorporated. Can you give me the context of that meeting, you know, what happened and why it's relevant to the current case against Trump?
Well, the way that meeting has been reported in multiple outlets now and relayed to me by my own sources is that Donald Trump essentially asked David Pecker, how can you help?
And David Pecker is the CEO of AMI, right?
Of AMI, at the time the parent company of the National Enquirer. And AMI and the National Enquirer had, for many years, established this practice of buying up stories that were unflattering to whatever celebrity, and then using that to either curry favor with that celebrity or strike a bargain where they would get exclusive access to them in return for killing that story. And Pecker's response to Trump posing that question of how can you help at this early and still precarious point in 2015 in the election cycle was, well, you know, we can acquire these stories that are out there about you and help make sure they never see the light of day. And that explicit agreement with an explicit intent of influencing the election is something that the Enquirer and people around Pecker, people around Trump, denied again and again to us when we were first doing this reporting at The New Yorker. And it's only over time, as it's become a matter of criminal proceedings, as various prosecutors have looked into it over time, that they've had to admit that this did happen. And that's exactly what transpired in the end. There was a moment where federal prosecutors were also looking at this, and Pecker and at least one of his sort of consiglieres at the Enquirer went in and turned sources for the prosecution. They cut a non-prosecution agreement where they acknowledged that this had happened, and they promised to not do any more crimes for a while, was the general tenor of that agreement.
So the Manhattan DA's case centers on records relating to payments that Trump made to the adult film star Stormy Daniels via Michael Cohen. You've reported extensively on two other hush money payments that were made as a result of this agreement, reporting that is now in the Manhattan DA's charging documents. Can you talk about those other payments, you know, who they were made to and why they were made?
Well, one of the most consequential developments was that the judge, Judge Mershon, let in evidence related to this broader pattern of payments. So that includes stories suppressed other than the Stormy story. One of them was this situation where a Trump Tower doorman was convinced that he had information that Donald Trump had had an affair with a Trump Tower employee, a housekeeper, and had fathered a love child. It was always referred to as the love child story at the Inquirer, because of course it's the Inquirer. We have no reason to believe anything one way or the other about the truth or falsehood of that rumor. And I was never, frankly, that interested in the truth or falsehood of the rumor, other than, you know, wanting to be respectful of this family. But it was apparent to me that the transaction where they paid this doorman for his silence had a potentially dicey interaction with election law. The payment was $30,000. This was in late 2015. And the way these deals are structured is they don't say we're going to kill the story in the contract. It's, I've seen some of these contracts. It's, well, we now have the exclusive rights to this rumor that Donald Trump may have fathered this child with this former employee. And it was in the late 80s that she was born, the child. And then there was $1 million penalty if this doorman, Dino Sajudin, ever disclosed that information elsewhere. 8 months after the payment to Sajudin, there was another payment to Karen McDougal. She was this former Playboy model who received $150,000 from AMI. And there again, you know, it's slightly veiled. They were promising her magazine covers and a recurring fitness column in exchange for her silence, essentially. You know, it said that they had the exclusive rights to affairs she had had. So that bound her from talking about this. And for a time did successfully take that story out of the electoral cycle. And then it was several months after that, that there was this other transaction with Stormy Daniels, which is slightly different in how it went down. The thing that our reporting indicated about how this scheme evolved was, after the Karen McDougal transaction, there was a lot of concern about how costly this was becoming. People around it, I think, were starting to realize that it was legally dicey and that there was this election law ramification that might eventually come to light. And so AMI didn't directly pay Stephanie Clifford, Stormy Daniels. They referred her to Michael Cohen, who was Trump's lawyer at the time, and he paid her $130,000 through a shell company he set up. So what you see across this pattern is Donald Trump wanting to insulate himself from unflattering press and going to great lengths to manipulate the news cycle to do that. And I think for any of us who are news consumers and believe in the power of accurate news to create an informed Democratic voting body should be troubled by this practice, which employees called catch and kill, which is now kind of a term that has gone into the zeitgeist.
As you mentioned, I mean, these payments to the doorman and to Karen McDougal are different from the Stormy Daniels payment, because that was done through Cohen rather than through AMI specifically. Why is it then that the other catch and kill payments are now being brought into the case against Trump?
Well, the way Judge Mershon talked about the significance of that additional contextual information was, he said, it's essential to establishing the narrative. And the narrative in question is, of course, that this was not some incidental matter. This wasn't about Trump's buddies just protecting him from being in an unflattering position with his wife. This was a scheme to protect a candidate from the disclosure of information during an election with an eye towards helping his candidacy. And so the fact that this wasn't just a one-off and that the transaction between Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels was part of this larger pattern goes to the question of intent pretty indispensably. It's not terribly surprising that that wider context was let in, or that prosecutors have included that from the early charging documents. And I think it would have been a pretty radical blow to their case if all of that context had been excluded.
Karen McDougal has now been allowed to testify in the trial. And I want to play a clip from your podcast, Catch and Kill, where she talks about how her relationship with Trump began.
The evening didn't go as planned. I thought I'd have dinner and go home and maybe have a job out of this. But the dinner turned into other things fairly quickly. I went to the bathroom and I came out and he was already undressing. I really didn't know what to think. I was shocked. I had so many thoughts going through my head. What do I do now? Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. What do you think at that moment? How do you get out of the situation?
So Trump still denies having had an affair with Karen McDougal, right?
He does, as far as he's made explicit comments about it. But people around Donald Trump, people around the situation, don't really describe him as going out of his way to deny this in private conversations. And even in the context of him aggressively using his bully pulpit all the time around this case, he hasn't devoted that much space to this idea of a denial of the affairs, which also is not that consequential to the heart of the matter, right? What mattered was the trail of transactions around the purported affairs. And those are real. They are documented. We have seen those contracts. And they do have a meaningful interaction with election law.
I'm curious about, like, AMI's decision to pick certain stories. And I mean, were they just kind of like, anything bad about Trump, let's catch and kill it? Or did it take a certain amount of, you know, kind of figuring out whether these things had some truth to them before they were willing to, you know, go forward with the money?
Well, I saw an AMI list that was maintained internally that had dozens and dozens of Trump-related stories on it. And to tamp down on any potential sensationalism and how that's interpreted, I've always been very clear about the fact that not all of those seemed like such bangers, you know? Like, a lot of these were like, I don't know, he's having a fight with Rosie O'Donnell. It was all kinds of stuff, some of it quite minor. But it does go to the depth of the alliance, the way in which David Pecker and people around him were banking on this being a good thing for them and were willing to go surprisingly far down the line of protecting him, even as it became more and more apparent that it could create complications for them from a self-interested standpoint. I mean, this is yet another illustration of the oldest cliche in the book, the cover-up is ultimately a much, much bigger story than any of the underlying things being covered up would have been. And I think the court is going to be acting on some of the same instincts that we had in a journalistic context, right? Which is they're proactively trying to avoid placing the emphasis on any of the underlying conduct. When the judge let in potential testimony from Karen McDougal, he also was very quick to limit that and to say, well, it's perhaps not necessary for jurors to hear about the purported affair, which happened supposedly while Melania was pregnant, you know, these kinds of details that might be prejudicial. He flagged that for that kind of testimony where there's relevant things to be disclosed about the transactions, but you don't want to get into prejudicing the views of the jurors on the personal matter involved, that there is this complicated balancing act of the probative versus the prejudicial.
So just to, like, clarify things for our listeners, because in New York State, falsifying bank documents is considered a misdemeanor, this idea that all of this stuff that was done, you know, was meant to influence the result of the 2016 election. That's kind of the main thing that the prosecutors have to make clear to the jury in order for this crime to be bumped up to a felony.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering how you think that the prosecutors are going to be able to make that clear, especially when it comes to, you know, stories about a potential love child or an affair. I just feel like it would be very easy for someone like Trump to kind of say, like, oh, I just didn't want that to be out there because it makes me look bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is why this has never struck most legal experts I've spoken to, and I won't call myself a legal expert, but I am a lawyer and reported on this. And frankly, I agree with this consensus view that essentially this is not a slam dunk case. You know, they're, as you noted, relying on this kind of bootstrapping legal theory where they could potentially elevate a misdemeanor into a felony if the misdemeanor is supporting the commission of another crime, a secondary crime. But there's not a lot of case law that really validates the idea that this kind of campaign finance violation can count as that sort of a secondary crime. So this ultimately is new territory legally under New York state level business records law. And from the very beginning, when this case was announced and we saw the first legal documents around it, there was, in my view, a degree of caginess around the legal theories being applied, trying to give them space to refine that. They still appear to be using that approach broadly, as you said, and that does create uncertainty.
So, Ronan, I'd like to ask you a bit more about the particulars of Trump's trial and what we can expect, but first we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment. If you like the show, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. And while you're there, don't forget to hit the follow button so you never miss an episode.
You come to The New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Karen McDougal has been allowed to testify. And I'm wondering what you think we can expect from her on the stand.
Well, Karen has made clear in her conversations with me and with other journalists that she does carry a certain amount of guilt. So the fact that she has been willing to turn whistleblower in an investigative journalism context is consequential. And I think means that you'll continue to see her try to help make sure that the truth outs on this matter. Now, we don't know exactly what she's going to be allowed to say. And that's, I imagine, going to be a contentious moment in court. As I mentioned before, the judge in this case has already said it's not necessary for jurors to hear about some of the underlying nitty-gritty of the affair.
Yeah, and also, I believe the judge has said that the prosecutors can't play the Access Hollywood tape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy.
Although it was entered into the record. So the prosecutor's argument that that is relevant information, that the fact that Trump said those things at that time, creating a furor around how he treated women, was, prosecutors asserted, relevant context for why there would be this desperate push to enact this deal and kill these stories. So they view the Access tape as narratively significant, and I think there's a pretty fair case for that, which explains why you've wound up in this case in the in-between space of that being part of the record, but not something that's going to be played, because of the prejudicial effect that it could have.
How do you think that'll actually play out in court if people aren't actually hearing the tape? Like, do you think it's just going to be different to hear this coming from the mouth of a lawyer or reading it via transcript rather than hearing the tape?
It's not the outcome that the prosecution would have wanted in terms of, you know, their effort to be frank, prejudice that jury against the defendant as much as possible. But I think it illustrates the measured approach this judge is taking at every turn, that he has taken these steps to signal fairness and honestly just to do his job in a fair way. He's allowed in some of the motions for the defense where they make sense. And I think all of that signaling of how fair and careful he's being has allowed him to then actually take a very hard stance on pushing back against all the delay tactics that Trump has thrown at this, and all of Trump's use of his social media and wider media bully pulpit to attack the proceedings, attack the judge himself, attack the judge's family. Trump has been very, very noisy around this case, even in apparent defiance of a gag order that went across in recent weeks. And next week, we're going to see a follow-up hearing on whether Trump, in fact, violated that gag order.
The judge has also said that prosecutors can't talk about the accusations of sexual assault that Trump faced in 2016. I'm wondering how you think that will impact the prosecution's case, or if you see that as separate.
I think that it's in the same category of a piece of context that is perhaps both unflattering and, you could argue, goes to this question of the heightened stakes that necessitated the deal. So there's this argument for why it would be relevant context. But I also see how the kind of display of measured jurisprudence coming from this judge makes a lot of sense given all of the context.
In terms of things that, you know, can be brought up during the trial and people who might take the stand, who are you looking forward to hearing from?
Well, everyone asks about the Karen McDougal testimony for a reason, I think. If indeed she does wind up speaking in this case, the potential introduction of Karen McDougal's voice could be something that prosecutors see as allowing them to stick the landing on asserting that this really was a collusion between Trump and a media entity to influence the election.
And what about David Pecker, the former AMI CEO? Is he supposed to take the stand, as far as you know?
Well, we know that he has been cooperative with various prosecutors looking at this from the jump, and that he's been someone who quickly gave up on that loyalty to Trump and that hope that he and his colleagues at AMI could ride the Trump train all the way to the top. You know, this is someone who has, at this point, fully turned whistleblower in a law enforcement context. So I would not be surprised to see him be a voluble source for prosecutors. We know he's met with them, and his testimony figuring would be an unsurprising development.
So Pecker's, you know, turn toward cooperating with the U.S. government, I mean, what has that meant for AMI? Like, surely doing that can't be good for business.
I mean, AMI is in shambles after all of this. And the various tabloid brands that they own have been shuffled off into new ownership. This matter, I think, came at a wider time of their market shrinking, their business shrinking, and was amongst several sort of endgame moments of flailing in which AMI personnel looked to political alliances as a bulwark against the end coming. And so the fact that they're no longer a culturally significant presence and that their brands exist nominally, but that trend that was already in progress of their circulation numbers getting smaller and smaller and the brands getting less and less value has plummeted in the wake of these scandals to new nadirs. I mean, that is also not terribly surprising to me based on what I saw and heard from sources around that place as all this stuff was coming to a head.
You know, given how much AMI did in 2016, I mean, is there anyone else who seems to be filling the AMI void for Trump during this election cycle, if not by catching and killing stories and just by helping him?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the apparatus Donald Trump was seeking to create through this alliance with AMI is now much more successfully in place in a wider sense. Not necessarily in the specific practice of catching and killing stories in this contractual way, but in a far-right media megaphone that he has at his full disposal. I mean, this is a moment where we are all in algorithmically siloed content universes, And he can really rely on a whole slew of mostly alt-right platforms, just giving him every possible defense and absolutely no criticism. So it's a precarious moment in terms of the media's role in policing candidates for higher office, because there is, in my view, more and more vibrancy and efficacy of the most troubling kind in the hyper-partisan press. And you could say that to some extent, in some ways, that's true on both sides of the aisle, but that would be a little mealy-mouthed. It really is, certainly around Trump, just this idiosyncratic moment where there is a very, very robust right-wing media culture that's coalesced around him.
So Trump doesn't even really need AMI or anything like it anymore to get rid of bad stories for him in some kind of contractual way.
Yeah. I mean, it's striking as this trial plays out to reflect on how far we are from the Donald Trump who would even be concerned about rumors of affairs. In fact, quite the contrary, the level of comfort that we've seen Donald Trump have with unflattering developments has just gotten higher and higher. His biggest fundraising days last year were around the announcement of charges against him in New York and in Georgia, where there's another electoral-focused case against him, as we know. So that was in April and August of last year, and it just directly coincided with these moments where he was getting booked. You know, this is a person who uses criminal proceedings against him as an opportunity to make hay, and has now, much more than then, this very muscular set of outlets around him that are willing to help with that. So in a sense, you know, the AMI empire may have been brought low by all of this and, you know, the Inquirer sold off for scrap to a new owner and all of that. But the mission of this alliance has in many ways been fully realized.
More with Ronan Farrow after the break. If you have thoughts or questions about today's episode, send us an email or a voice memo to themail@newyorker.com. Be sure to put the political scene in the subject line.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
You know, a big part of this case is basically the prosecutors arguing in the charging documents that had these stories, about Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal gone public before the election, you know, Trump might not have won. And I'm wondering if you think that, you know, that in such a close election that the stories that AMI caught and killed would have made a difference, or if we're actually kind of in a moment now where we're realizing that no amount of unseemly behavior could have stopped Trump from winning.
It's a tricky one. I mean, I've never been of the opinion that if the stories of these affairs were out there, it would have had a terribly consequential electoral implication. But I simultaneously always thought that the transactions and their legality were real news and should actually be viewed consequentially by voters. The fact that a candidate is willing to so aggressively manipulate the media. And far from welcoming transparency, is putting up these smoke screens and is willing to break the law and fudge the rules and do shady accounting to achieve that. That, to me, felt like a real story that voters should be aware of. But no, that part of the irony of the whole thing is that I can't imagine voters learning of a couple more affairs by Donald Trump would have a whole lot of consequence for the vote.
One of the larger themes of your reporting is how the women who signed these kinds of exclusivity agreements ended up getting screwed over. You know, if their story was caught and killed, then it didn't make it to the public. And, you know, it's not even necessarily the case that they were able to reap the financial benefits of the deal that they signed. Like, you reported that after lawyer fees, Karen McDougal only ended up getting a little over half the $150,000 she was ostensibly paid for instance. I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit more about the personal impact that these catch-and-kill agreements have had on the sources who you spoke with.
Well, there's a wider question of the sources more broadly who take payments and sign NDAs of one kind or another to suppress something that they or others might think important to the discourse. And I think that over and over again, I see how that weighs on decent people and is an unpleasant thing to go through. And I think that explains why so many of the stories that powerful moneyed interests seek to suppress through these kinds of mechanisms ultimately come to light, because those kinds of silencing agreements, in some cases anyway, just don't hold because people have a personal compunction with them that develops over time. And you can hear that in Karen's quotes to me over the course of our stories on this subject. In terms of the other sources, the other individuals who were party to these transactions in this case, Dino the doorman seems to be doing okay. he seems pretty eager to play this in a way that works best for him, and not particularly traumatized by these events. I think he found working in that context of Trump Tower to be unpleasant and felt there was a lot of intimidation and strong-arming. As for Stormy Daniels, you know, she's had a complicated go of it in the public discourse since all of this. I won't speak for her. You'd have to ask her what she feels the balance of good and bad in that has been. None of this is black and white. And for some of these people, you know, on a purely personal level, maybe the transaction in the end winds up being not such a terrible thing. That's an individual call, but none of it changes, I think, the underlying most important reality for voters and for anyone invested in media transparency and informed democracy, which is this kind of practice by candidates for higher office, and the moves to conceal the practice, is a problem. It does keep voters away from information that they might want access to.
You talked a little bit earlier about some of the, the weird legal technicalities of the case. And, we could spend all day talking about whether these were charges that even should have been brought against Trump to begin with. But I wonder if there is just some value in not only the public finally hearing stories that were killed a long time ago that they weren't given access to during a period where they were making a very important decision, which was who they wanted to vote for president. But also, the women who have been maligned by Trump for years and, you know, have had the public question their stories, you know, the fact that we're finally hearing these things now during Trump's trial, if like that alone is something of a win, in the same way that, you know, when the writer E. Jean Carroll had her recent trials against Trump and was awarded $83 million in damages, just the fact that a jury agreed with her was a huge victory after Trump had spent, you know, years defaming her.
Yeah. Well, in some of these cases, as you point out, part of being at odds with Donald Trump is to get the full force blast of him being a public bully, which he does over and over again, which he's doing around this case. He is just in the last couple of days launching a renewed effort to whip up his base against this judge and this DA and so on. So you're absolutely right that any cases where there's legal vindication of what those folks were up against in confronting Donald Trump, you know, probably does redress this imbalance we see, where now there's a media environment where a deal with a tabloid isn't even needed. There's really just like a pretty smooth, free ride in a huge segment of very powerful partisan media.
Thank you so much, Ronan.
Yeah, thank you. Always a pleasure, Tyler.
Ronan Farrow is a contributing writer to The New Yorker. You can read his reporting on AMI, as well as his groundbreaking reporting on Harvey Weinstein, which kicked off the Me Too movement and won Ronan a Pulitzer, at newyorker.com. And if you want to learn more about the catch-and-kill scheme at the heart of Trump's criminal trial, you should also check out Ronan's deeply reported podcast. It's called Catch and Kill. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Stephanie Karayuki, with production assistance from Jake Loomis and Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.